So briefly bring us to up to where we are. And so we've done four positions so far. We did Rav Avadia at great length. Rav Avadia said that in the end, that the rescue mission in Entebbe was legitimate, but also that the negotiations prior to the rescue mission in Entebbe was legitimate. Even and he ended up, he ruled that even though the I guess there were two things he wasn't quite good at. One is maybe releasing terrorists is not considered to be overpaying. He didn't really explain why, and he wasn't consistent about that. And the other, which he was fairly consistent about, is that Tosfot gives two reasons as to why Rav Yehoshua ben Hananiah overpaid to rescue a particularly both attractive and intelligent hostage in Rome, or prisoner in Rome. One was that the kid was in danger of death, and you redeem people facing death. And the other is that the kid was going to be a great Talmid Chacham, overpay for great Talmid Chachamim. Rav Avadia proved that the Piskei Tosfot rules like both of those reasons, and therefore he said that means that each of those reasons must be independently sufficient, and therefore the rule against overpaying for captives doesn't apply either when the captives are in danger of death, as the captives in Entebbe were, or when the captives are Talmidei Chachamim, in which he did not discuss the scholarship of the hijacked prisoners in Entebbe. Right, we saw three other positions. We saw that Rav Yitzchok Ralbag, writing later after what we thought was probably the Jibril hostage release, which actually happened, unlike Entebbe, which was hundreds to one release, possibly included the person who became the mastermind of the Lockerbie bombing. Yitzchok Ralbag nonetheless thought that not only was it legitimate to engage in that release, but it was mandatory, and people, right, because his argument was that the only halachic decision to make was that it's legitimate to rescue captives, even by overpaying. And once that's the case, so you could argue, but of course you don't do that if it endangers other people excessively. But that's a government decision. Does it endanger other people excessively? And if the government decides it doesn't, so that determines the halachic position. The halachic position is it doesn't endanger people excessively. And once it doesn't endanger people excessively, so to oppose the release of terrorists for hostages would be a violation of the obligation to save lives. That seemed a very, very peculiar position, right? That he thought that it was halakhically forbidden to disagree with the government's determination of the security, because we just bracket that. Security is the government's decision. I just saw that Rabbi Jonathan Ziering has a lecture put out last year, which you just sent me, on whether generally it's legitimate for poskim to just delegate the question of facts and say that facts are not, when we make a halachic decision, we just decide the law, they decide the facts. Some people take that position, other people, I think, take more. He goes through various, other people argue that that the poskim has an obligation to evaluate the facts on their own, or to refuse to poskim the facts except just to say that whoever's asking the question gets to decide the facts, and I'm only poskiming for your set of facts. But the notion that you can't argue with the government's decision about facts has struck me. I think I was very harsh. I said that I think Rabbi Ralbag simply didn't understand democracy. governments don't make truer decisions about security. They make decisions about security, security that are, that are also tinged with self-interest and politics and things like that. To say that you can't disagree because the government made that decision is really, really strange. Rabbi Ziering points out that Elazar Malamed made an interesting similar argument about land for peace, where he said that you might say that it's just a political decision, what will be the effects of land for peace be, but that your decision about what to do will depend on how much you value Eretz Yisrael. If you really value holding onto the land as a primary value, then you'll be willing to take more risks. So obviously, the government decision is a values decision as opposed, and not just a fact decision. I think that's right. That there's no such thing as a neutral evaluation of the facts, and therefore the notion that you can just say, okay, we're only deciding values, and you decide facts without regard to values, that I don't think is a I think that's sort of an abdication of responsibility. It made very little sense to me. But Mordechai Eliyahu, really, we thought was harsher with Rav Ralbag than I was. say damning with faint praise was the right framing, where, you know, where he said that, well, this article feels, you know, this article reads like somebody who's actually dealt with lofty questions before. really odd, right? Really, really, you know, really, really wild. But really, yeah, well, the other way, he said that, he said that, well, I know the government made this decision, but all the experts that I care about think that it was a dumb decision and a dangerous decision, and therefore, how could you possibly say it's legitimate when all the experts thought that this hostage release was negotiated poorly and has terrible consequences? And we tried to figure out, like, why does he get to pick his experts over anyone else's? You know, his experts are particular people with political perspectives. So there, you know, so we thought that both of those positions were strange. The position that, at least I did, I shouldn't project on all of you, that Rabbi Lach's position that the halacha can't, halacha can only make the decision that it's theoretically legitimate, and then the government makes all other subsequent decisions, and you can't argue with them. And Rabbi Eliezer's notion that the government's decision is illegitimate because he has a roster of experts. Now, you may think that they include the experts. Some of them were people involved working for the government, and since the people who work for the government think it was done badly, therefore it wasn't actually permitted. That's also a little bit strange. And then we went to Rav Asher Weitz. Rav Asher Weitz essentially said, this is not a halachic decision. Right? This is the kind of decision that should be made by a government. Because we're not, right? It's not a private decision. Right? What he said is that all the halachic precedents are about a private community, right? Not a government, which is holding people for, right? Which is dealing with members of its community that were held for ransom, meaning the primary purpose of it was to get money. And here you're dealing with a government which has different responsibilities than a community, and you're dealing with people who are not being held hostage for ransom. They might, right? It might be they'll take a ransom, but that's not why they're being held hostage. So he thought that was he thought it was totally irrelevant. Like people, you know, right? That there's no point in claiming this halachic precedent. Right? All the halachic precedents are irrelevant. And so that's the third, right? That's the third position. Really, all four of them take different positions, not just on the wisdom, but also on how halacha ought to relate to the reality. What I argued was that the three positions subsequent to Rav Avadia essentially all accept Rav Avadia's framing of the halachic question. Right? They don't quite cite any sources he doesn't. Right? They don't cite any, right? The only question they're debating is, given that according to halacha it is possible to legitimate overpaying for captives, now what do we do? They don't disagree with Rav Avadia's fundamental framing. So what we'll see tonight, and that hopefully we'll finish, we'll see, right? We're going to do Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, the Bnei Vanim. Now, Rav Avadia wrote about Entebbe. The Rav Robag and Mordechai Eliyahu wrote about Jibril, we assume, because they're writing around 1985. Rav Asher Weitz was dealing with the contemporary situation. With Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, we're going back to Entebbe. And he writes his piece in the aftermath of Rav Avadia's Entebbe Tshuva, but not in the context of any subsequent hostage releases. And let's see, I think that you'll see, which is not, you know, which I think would be expected of Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, and it gives you a sense of who, I think you got to see very much who Rav Asher Weitz was last week. It was a very common sense, practical, you know, understand the limits of halacha. Rav Herzl Henkin is a highly idiosyncratic, original thinker. And so he's the only one who is not going to take Rav Avadia's framework as given. But, you know, now you also see that he lost in the sense that nobody after, right, you know, the people afterwards just quote, right, just quote Rav Avadia, right, and nobody even bothered responding to him at that point. This is also, I think that perhaps if he had written, you know, I think Rav Henkin grew in stature some years later. And so maybe if he had written it some years later, it would have had more impact. But at the time, he was, you know, he was the rabbi of a small community, and the Nishman Institute was not yet famous, which his wife made famous. That also added to his added to his stature. But he was, you know, and he became later when Nishman expanded to the Yoetzet program. So right, so he was a halachic authority for that. So I think that Rav Henkin's stature has grown since then, but this tshuva, I think, probably, pretty much went by the wayside. We're going to reclaim it now, but it's interesting to think about how it is. Okay, so here we go. We're on page three. So he says, Hatzalat b'nei Aruvah, so saving a group of people who have been captured, u'pulat tzva'it, and military endeavors to do that. And this is Tafshin Lamed Tet. Right, so Tafshin Lamed Tet, we are in 1979. Right, and Tebi is in 1976. Right, so we're shortly thereafter. This is Nish'alti b'shivat Erev, so I was asked in an evening symposium, whatever, u'pulat tzva'it l'shakrer shvuyim b'Uganda, about the military mission to rescue the captives in Uganda, that it involved danger to the captives. So his response is, he's responding to voices that he understands as saying that the mission in Uganda was illegitimate, not because there was an obligation to release prisoners in exchange for hostages. Right, going further than Ravadia said that it was legitimate, but he's saying, essentially, he's responding to the voice that we saw later embodied in Rabbi Robag, which is that, right, that once it's legitimate, release hostages, so unless you have an unanswerable military reason not to release the hostages, the default has to be to release the hostages as opposed to a military mission.
The prisoners, I'm sorry.
Release it for prisoners, right, mm-hmm. Because the military mission endangers the prisoners and also endangers the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
So what entitles you to risk lives on both sides rather than paying once paying is legitimate? Right, that's what he's arguing against. So he says, Trila, so I want to start by saying, he says, Laniut dati, in my humble opinion, ain isur lehanot ledrishat tukhulfim leshachrir acheyem b'chela mitam takadam chazal b'mishnah masecha gittin ain put in ashrim yetzer el kadeh demand. So the first question he says is, well, maybe I could argue with them in principle and say, no, we're not allowed to respond. You can't release terrorists, right, and create a communal danger in order to release prisoners. He says, no, that's wrong. I agree with Rav Avadia that the prohibition, and with Rav Asher Weiss, although we'll see whether it's for their reasons, that the prohibition against overpaying for captives doesn't apply to releasing terrorists. Why? So here he gives a fascinating new reason. He says, Kevan, because he says, I think that the release of terrorists doesn't violate the standard of overpaying. It's not Yosher Michdei Demehem. Why it's not Yosher Michdei Demehem? So he says there are two positions about what it means to overpay. One, as we saw in Maram Lilublin, is the notion that overpaying means paying more than you would pay for them on the slave market.
Mm-hmm.
And the second, which he puts the name of Radbaz and I put the name of Common Sense, was paying more than non-Jews would pay for the same, right, for the same number of prisoners. Right? It's paying for Jews more than you would pay for non-Jews.
Say that again?
Overpaying means paying more for Jews than the market for non-Jews. Not the market for slaves, but the market for prisoners. So if a non-Jewish government would release 1,000 terrorists in exchange for one of their citizens, then you too, as a Jew, are allowed to release 1,000 terrorists in exchange.
It's what non-Jewish nation,
yeah,
would pay for its hostages.
Right, that's the market. It's not the slave market; it's the hostage market.
What's the going rate?
Right. What's the going rate? He says those are the two. Those are the two possible options. Right now, he says skip to the. Skip to the line above the second asterisk. He says, so not only according to the Maram Lilublin that we saw inside, he says that it's a slave market. That we measure it by what is the going price to redeem Gentile captives, so we can pay for Jews whatever they pay for Gentiles, even if the market for hostages is above the market for slaves, even if there is no market for slaves. Those are the two positions. And here's his line. He says, because go see. Europa, in all European states, terrorists are capturing hostages. He thinks that at the time of writing, all the European states are releasing terrorist prisoners when the terrorists succeed in capturing their citizens. Therefore, Israel would not be overpaying. Okay, holy news, right? So, yes.
Is he making, so in bringing up this argument,
Yeah.
separate from what I might initially think about it, is he bringing this up as just a this makes sense argument, or this is the halakha set has this rule
Yeah.
that seems to apply, as we've heard in one of the other
Yeah.
arguments, was it Weiss's?
Yeah.
He said, listen, that was another world,
Right, no, he
that
doesn't say
rule,
that.
right? Okay, but is there the
Okay, I can say it does apply,
Hekim,
but we're meeting it.
he's saying actually it does apply. There's a very close analogy or whatever you want to call it, and we can look at what the market rate is in the general world for redeeming hostages.
Right. That
Okay, so he's making not a logical argument. I mean, he's also doing that, but he's really making a halachic
That's
argument.
right.
We have some established halacha. This fits the mold, so let's go to town on that.
Right. So that's the whole right, so that's a whole new argument. Right, that the standard is that that the standard is set by the hostage market. Who cares if it's money? And who cares, right? Who cares if it's money or it's prisoners? The standard is whatever gets paid the hostages. And interesting question whether Europe should be the so what should what should be the defining market in right, what if European states do it but Asian states don't? South American states don't?
Right. It seemed more prevalent that every other month a European plane was hijacked for hostage negotiations, whether it
So,
involved Jews, Israelis, or
yeah. So
not.
back then, right? That
It
back then,
was just what was shkiach at the
right?
time.
And the terrorist organizations actually shared personnel, right? Munich, for
But
example, right? Was a, it was a shared across communists and Palestinian, and right?
if you're going to start raising these sorts of questions, there you could raise I'll call them technical questions about, okay, you make a general argument that says we do have a market. So and you can debate whether that is a reasonable argument to make. But if you accept that we do have a market, then you get into the muck of
Is this within the market or not, right?
or what do we actually know about that market? So, not that I know much about hostages, but what little I read in the papers is that governments do a lot of different things, and we don't always know what's going on. So, but that becomes a really technical
I think there's
question
also the
about.
question of time. I know the price at which Apple stock closed at close of markets today. That doesn't mean I have any idea where it's going to open when the market's open tomorrow.
There's no ongoing market, right? There's no
Right.
centralized place,
It's all these discrete
right?
moments, and are we talking about like over the last 10 years, or are we talking about over the last century, or
It's really pretty wild.
yeah, like
It's pretty wild. Right? He's
But like
the,
if
but
no, that's again, that's a technical question
right.
about how skilled are we in measuring something, how capable are we of
Yeah.
measuring it,
Right.
that which is different from a halakhic question of
Except if also sets a standard, there has to be a way of evaluating it, right? To set a standard,
not
halakha can't.
necessarily. Maybe that you have a market back then that's more open and and more stable, and here you may have a market where it's quite opaque.
Good. So now, what do I do now, right? You're right that
Right.
it's not an unreasonable standard for the past. The question is, if he wants to provide guidance for the current thing, right? So, what if somebody gets up and says, "I think that the going rate is"? Five terrorists, one of whom has blood on their hands, and one of whom has an incurable disease that will kill them the week after they leave. And you have six terrorists right now. It's true, none of them has blood on their hands, but none of them are dying either, right? So you get into there's a short story I love called "The Day They Got Boston," which was a nuclear war parable in which the Soviet Union, which the U.S. accidentally launches a missile and wipes out Leningrad, right, during the Cold War. And after a long time, the Soviet Union is convinced that actually this was an accident, but it thinks that that just in principle it has to get one U.S. city back. So after long negotiations, they settle on Boston. They decide like, has the right number of museums and the right number of universities. But it turns out afterwards that they missed the
They missed the, actually, I think it's the other way around. They get Boston and the U.S. find the Akers in Leningrad. And it turns out they missed the fact that the prime minister's daughter was in Leningrad, and the U.S. president's daughter was not in Boston. And so, you know, so like a week afterwards, the Russians say, you know, it was close, but we think we need another one. And the last, you know, and the last line is soon they would begin to insist. And so, like, those kind of evaluations are very tenuous. So I think that's I think that Ravenkin seems to, you know, establish that once the market is terrorist, so we can treat release of terrorists as a zero, as a commodity. All terrorists are the same thing. That's not obvious to me at all that you can do that. And he doesn't address the question, but he will later on, which is, okay, so maybe we'll say is we're not sure, right? Later on, I'll talk about, so what do we do in situations, now we have a suffix. So what do we do in situations of suffix as to whether it's overpaying for terrorists?
Mm-hmm. Right, he's not yet dealing with the issue of futures and terrorists that will be repeat offenders.
That too. Okay, this is his first one.
I was a big troublemaker around here.
It says, Bimchein, Apple Pish lo nichelon shetasena memshelo kein, even if our preference would be if the European governments would not negotiate with terrorists, right? That was part of what was going on in Israeli policy. It was getting pressured, right? Because all the Jews who were captured were citizens, right? Among them were citizens of other countries. And so the other countries, right, who were negotiating with terrorists would put pressure on Israel. Well, you need to release these terrorists so that we could release these German French citizens, whatever you want to call it. So we would rather that, you say, let's suppose we would rather that the universal policy was not to create a market for hostages. But there is, so I can't tell you halakhically that you're not allowed to do it. Okay, so even though it's better for us not to do it, nonetheless, the release of imprisoned terrorists can't be called overpaying, because that's the custom. But there's no rabbinic thing. Now he has an addendum. He says, that's what I said in 1976 in the summer. But the reality has changed since then.
It's the time frame question.
Right, and it's no longer the case. The European states have all come around, and no one negotiates with terrorists anymore. They're not willing to release prisoners. So if that's the case, it says now everyone agrees. Right, if other governments will not negotiate and we do negotiate, that means that we are overpaying. Certainly, according to Radbaz. And then he says, you know what, I think even the Maram would disagree. All the Maram said was that if there is a slave market, then you can use, right, then you can't pay more than the slave market, even if the hostage market is more. But of course Maram agrees that when there's no slave market, you can't pay more than the going price for hostages.
But there's a certain circularity here in the sense that aren't we part of the market? So if we say we're going to pay this for a hostage, then that's the going rate.
It's a fiction.
What's another fun thing you could have? Like, so our strategy for dealing with hostage takers should be to we do whatever the Europeans are doing this week.
All claims, right? let's say we just talk about, right, that you can't charge more than market, but you can't charge more than 20% above market price, right? That has lobbying implications. So again, right, you know, what's the market price? You paid it, right? The market price would change. I think the fiction of the market is one that exists all across economic halakha. Mm-hmm. And so I don't mind him applying it.
Okay.
I don't mind him applying it here. What I think is fascinating is the way he manipulates the past halakha, right? Look, you know, I think it's a really interesting claim. You have these two positions. One is the slave market, the other is the hostage market. And then he just says, okay, but the person who says slave market only does that in case the slave market is above the hostage market. But they agree that when the slave market is below the hostage market, you certainly can't, right? You certainly can't pay more than the hostage market. And now it's a consensus you can't pay more than the hostage market. And now in 1979, right, that means you can't negotiate with terrorists even though you could in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, we're just following what the world does, which is a really interesting passive notion. Although he hasn't said in any way, as opposed to Rabbi Bach, he hasn't said that if you are allowed to pay more than the market, therefore you have to.
Right.
It's just said that the decision is not, there's no longer a halachic barrier to doing it. Whereas if no one else negotiates with terrorists, there is a halachic barrier in being the one who establishes the market. Okay, right. Really, you know, I agree that the this works well if you only, right, you know, as a, or at least works as a binary claim. But if you start, right, if you have to start figuring out what the market is, I just have no idea how you would possibly go about it. Unless, so Rav Elazar Melamed, we're not going to do. Rav Elazar Melamed has written in the current environment that he thinks that that a market, or should no, either here, maybe Rav Granot has written it, that he thinks the market is one for one. Because he thinks you revert to the slave market. So you revert to the slave market, all you can do it, so you can trade slaves. And that's it. But so you can't release more than one terrorist per hostage.
If we go back to this idea about not, we're not allowed to pay more than the market price, is that a rule that is in place because we fear what will happen? If you do that?
So we're going to go back to the Gemara, right? We're going to get there. Right? The Gemara has two possible reasons. One possibility is we're afraid that we were incentivizing capture.
Right.
The other possibility is that we'll bankrupt the community. And obviously the first reason applies really well to the terrorists. And the second, you know, okay, what's the problem we've run out of terrorists in prison terrorists? Right? It's not a big deal that the community is going to be poor if we don't have enough, in prison terrorists. Aside from the question of whether there's always a backlog of usual suspects whom you can arrest and then release in exchange for the hostages.
So at least going with the first reason about we'll incentivize terrorists, it's a strategic reason.
Yeah.
And so this gets back to this thing where you were commenting earlier about the thinking it's strange to defer to governments.
Yeah.
These things. But maybe one of the and this is something one of the many things I know nothing about. How does halacha deal with evaluate, or what are the ways in which halacha deals with evaluating a situation where to assess it, you have to forecast what's going to happen in the future? Which is another way of saying making a strategic decision, and that assessment is almost definitionally, you know, it's kind of opaque. I think it's like the future.
I think it's true in all areas of law, right? Law always shades into policy,
mm-hmm.
and you never know that for sure. The question is going to be the relationship. You know, who makes the decision? And you can argue that the POSIG makes the decision. You can argue that the government makes the decision. That's sort of a box thing. You can argue that in practice, the government makes the decision, but the government in a democracy is influenced by people, and people get to make up their own minds and try to influence the government.
But if in our situation, if the POSIG is making the decision, POSIG presumably lacks a lot of pieces of information.
Like anybody.
But critical pieces of
information. Depends. Rav was briefed by Rabbi about it in Tevi.
Okay. Well, maybe in that case not. But I can easily imagine, you know, all sorts of things about, okay, we're going to let this guy out of jail. What's going to be the impact of that? What, you know, might he become the next Sinwar who does something?
That's right.
Or maybe there's, you know, an argument to be made that if we follow this policy, the chances of the next Sinwar, you know, coming about one way or another, go down by 1%, and you know all these.
I think that's true. I don't think that it's unique. At the end of the day, right? You know, at the end of the day, you know, I think it'd be very. It's. I think Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was kind of odd. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, right, who said it was forbidden,
mm-hmm.
right? So he was briefed mm-hmm. by Rafael Eitan, who was a former commander in chief of the armed forces and had been mm-hmm. and was at that time was a member of Knesset.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought he had enough information. You could argue with humility not that you have to defer to the government, but that to tell people. And so I think to tell you that you can't disobey orders because you can't have that kind of confidence, and you're only the only effect of might, let's say, suppose I were to prosecute this officer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like Rabbi Henkin,
mm-hmm.
right? So right in the contemporary, in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
So I can say the most I can tell you is it's usher, and therefore you should try to persuade the government to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I can't say it's usher, and therefore disobey the government, because I can't have that kind of certainty.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's perfectly reasonable. I just don't like the notion that you have enough confidence to justify rebellion, although there have to be circumstances in which revolution is justified. We have to figure out what the parameters are. I don't like Dina Malchusa being an absolute.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I think that the notion that people have no responsibility for the judgments of their government in a democracy is a very bad idea, and we should try to live in democracy. So I don't think that's a problem for halacha, and it's more than any other private citizen making a judgment. So if this is your value system, this is a judgment you make according to your value system. I don't see that as unique. I think it's when you try to claim authority over people and say they have to listen to you, right? That gets to the red. But I'm not claiming authority over people. If I make a decision, I'm saying this is what I think halacha says.
Mm-hmm.
And then, any halachic decision involves a ruling about facts, and people should always hold themselves accountable for making sure that the halachic decision was made with a reasonable assessment of the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And where it has a doubt built in, I think the facts are wrong. So under most circumstances, I think it's a mistake for a posek to see their position as binding. But where this came up, that's what I was talking about in the right hearing. Is what happens if I truly believe that the measles vaccine is dangerous? Is dangerous for my kid, right? But all the public health authorities say that the trade-off, right, is for society is much better if everyone vaccinates, right? And so I can paskin that the community is entitled to compel people to vaccinate,
mm-hmm.
right? That I can do. Whether I can paskin that an individual is compelled to vaccinate if they genuinely have a differently held factual belief is a challenging thing. I can say, look, I can posture that as a community, we won't let you into shul if you're not vaccinated. But I don't know that, right? But I think that's a very different thing because the community is entitled to make a decision. And the community's decisions are, the facts are such for them, I can posture according to the community. If the community vests in me the decision to make that, right? Say, look, we trust that you have a good enough sense of the facts that we want you to make that decision, great. But whether I can paskin that for an individual who disbelieves that, I can say, well, I can paskin is that, I can paskin you're insane, right? But do you have to accept my psak that you're insane? I think that's the same issue here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I paskin, to the extent that we share a set of facts, I can paskin for you. And the extent that you think that my certainty, right, my certainty about the facts is irrational, you shouldn't follow me. And the community can decide whether it wishes to make my decision enforceable. Or not, it would be unwise of me in a situation where I have no government position to make my to declare that my position was enforceable.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think. I think there isn't enough thought about the. My predecessor at Harvard Hill, I thought, made a very important distinction. Rabbi Harry Sinoff made an important distinction about whether he wanted to make decisions that set precedent or not. So when he was asked the question, he wanted to set a precedent, he would write it down and enter it into the files. And when he didn't, he would just decide it. There would be no record. If the question came up again, then the next rabbi could decide differently. and that was someone with a law degree and a good consciousness of the way in which halacha has a political function. Right. So I think that here also, right, I would be very hesitant about saying that people had to follow my psak on issues like this. But if you ask me what my psak is, like everybody else, I have to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Do I vote for the government, right, for the party that made this decision, or against the party that made this decision? Do I participate in the demonstration trying to get the government to change its mind? Do I not participate in that? I can say, look, I think that in the value structure we have, you should all go demonstrate. Or you shouldn't go demonstrate. I don't think that I should set you up and say that you're right, that you can't obey the government. Right? That, mm-hmm. that I think is an extreme position. But it's subtle. And you can see, there are people foundering on the shoals here as they try and navigate between us. I guess the Sil and Kribbis are saying halacha can't say anything about reality. We just have these, vague value stations. And saying halacha controls your life because somebody learned a lot of halacha, that means they know geopolitics. okay. So now, right. So this. So the first contribution of Henkin makes is to make the claim that, in fact, we have a contemporary market that is halakhically relevant, and that the contemporary market is the international, or, he thinks the European market, whatever the, I guess I would say, the collective decision of governments who are currently subject to terrorist attacks to take hostages. And if the collective decision is that there is a market, such that, when you enter the decision, both the terrorists and the government basically know what the parameters are. Right now we can negotiate, just so we can negotiate the market, but we know, like, this is, mm-hmm. as long as you're working within that, you're okay, right? I think that might be a way to solve the practical problem, right? It's just by, if you were in any other government and somebody made this proposal, would they be laughed at? Or everyone say, okay, that's a good starting point, right? We're not sitting our negotiators home, but, we think you should, in addition to releasing hostages who have, right, we're not releasing hostages with X crimes. We also look at certain skills we need, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So two plumbers.
So, how much of halacha follows a if then else structure?
I think if you ask a policy question, it's going to have policy, right? It's going to have policy implications. If you ask a question that isn't obviously policy, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
Everything relates to policy, but some questions, are not so consequential. There's some questions you can handle without thinking about such a consequentialist way, and some things you have to deal with consequentialism.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my take.
I mean, one of the ways it comes up is in these assessments about the price to be paid, and here sometimes the price is in money, sometimes the price is in 1-for-1 or 100-for-1.
Yeah. But we have a halakhic standard. Like, standard is will it incentivize people?
Which is a different sort of price, right? So if you believe 1,000-for-1 won't incentivize
to capture Jews more than non-Jews, right? That's in this framework. That's the standard that incentivizes people to capture your people when they have a choice between capturing Jews and capturing. What's the fictional country Grand Fenwick is, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a choice. So you don't want to incentivize them to capture Jews instead of Grand Fenwickians, or to capture Jewish Grand Fenwickians as opposed to non-Jewish Grand Fenwickians, because mm-hmm. that's the point of paying the market price.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. And
so, just taking a little bit of a step back, is there any consideration of the price? Other prices that are paid. I'm thinking about what we're seeing now, where if there is a prisoner swap at some point, or hostages for prisoners, they may be getting a whole bunch of prisoners out of prison, but they're also getting clobbered. Like Gaza's basically pulverized. So, I mean, we could give them a whole lot of prisoners. And they still they might still be at a net loss.
So it might, right? So it might be. And, unlike Rabbi Weiss, Rabbi Weiss was writing in the context of the current situation.
Mm.
Rabbi Henke was not dealing with the current situation. And you could argue that, but I think this will move you into Rabbi Weiss's world, where saying you can't compare it because in the Gemara's case, there was nothing you were doing other than paying. But if what you're doing is paying, and then you can paying in prisoners, but then that means you can freeze their bank accounts,
right?
All sorts of other things you can do, right? That might change the calculation, right? It's really interesting to me that Rehankin pushes to make it relevant. I think he argues it's not true that Chazal wouldn't have had something to say about this. They were trying to accomplish things, and mm-hmm. so that, right. Mm-hmm. And you can always distinguish cases. Your job is a pussy. There is, to this extent, I mean, I don't think it's fair to bring it in. I think, and so there's a debate that became famous in a sense in the modern Orthodox world. The debate between Rabbi J. David Bleich, my teacher, and Rabbi Ezra Bick of Yeshivat Har Etzion. They're dealing with the question of how you deal with the parenthood of children born with born with the donated eggs and things like that, and Rabbi Bleich said he thought the answer was this based on analysis of precedent, And Roy Bick said, look, here's the Gemara. Here are my five conceptual models. They each yield different outcomes. It's obvious that this case is sufficiently different from the past that you can't decide which of these models is a better extension of the past. So don't pretend you actually have a locking precedent. And Rabbi Mike said, the job of a posek is when there are multiple models, each of which are plausible, to pick one. So that's what I'm doing. All right, and that might go back to an earlier dispute between the Shach and the Chazon Ish. That whole question whether I have that right or not, about who said to me that way. I lose confidence over time remember which of my teachers said that. But that's the same, right? Rabbi Weiss's position could theoretically be taken to wipe all of halacha out, because nothing of halacha deals with exactly with the past circumstances. Some years ago, at the launch of Ethan Tucker and Michael Rosenberg's book on egalitarianism, so I was one of the panelists. And the move that they make essentially is that our women are not women in the classical terms. So the halachot about women don't apply to our women. And I said, okay, that's a move. It's not an illegitimate move, but it's a move that is potentially is a nuclear weapon, because you can do it about anything. And Professor Judith Heltman said, you can't do about anything, right? What about pigs? And I said, you think our pigs are genetically related to biblical pigs? No, right? They can't interbreed, right? What makes you think that those are the same, right? Of course, you can do it in any situation you want. So I tend to be, except the things I really, really want, right? I tend to be very resistant to claims that radical paradigm shifts have happened, because you can always make halacha irrelevant. So I understand why Rabbi Henkin is resistant to the move, right? I think he understands the move Rabbi Weiss would make, right? He anticipates it, and he says, I'm not going there, because if I'm willing to say that about this, I'm going to have to say that about lots of things. And Rabbi Weiss doesn't have that problem. He says, no, I know where to say it, where not to say it. It's one of the amazing things of Rabbi Weiss is that he's willing to say things like that and doesn't feel it as a threat. It's like one of the things Rabbi Weiss says that nobody else has said, I think, ever, is in certain financial areas of halacha, and he has a very prominent financial Beit Din. He says, you know what, halacha doesn't have the tools yet to deal with the situation. We haven't dealt with enough cases like this. And secular law does. And because secular law does, so we're just going to follow secular law on this issue, because it has tools we don't have, and we don't have the tools yet, right? That's an amazing admission, right? Not that we couldn't have the tools, not that we won't eventually have the tools, but right now we don't have the tools, but we don't want halakha to have holes, so we're just going to implement secular law. Now, the all sorts of reasons that secular law is controlling halakha under certain circumstances.
Does the implementation of secular law in a circumstance like that become halakhic precedent?
Yeah, sure.
So then it becomes a halakhic tool.
Yeah, it'll be different in different places, and eventually, right? People, right? There'll be some kind of interstate clash, or some kind of interstate clash, and you have to develop some kind of autonomous halakhic things to deal with choice of laws and all. But but the frank admission that there are just things that we don't, right? That the world has changed in all sorts of dramatic ways, and halakha has not yet kept up in the realm of finance, and so we need to import the tools that secular law has found effective in other situations. And that doesn't mean that halacha is useless, right? Because you can see people are afraid of saying that, because it's, look, so why bother having halacha at all? And the answer is because there are certain circumstances where the secular tools are useless to us because they infringe our values. But where it is, right? So, Rabbi Weiss is very consistent. This is who he is. And I don't know Rabbi Henkin's position about that, but it seems like, I think reasonably he would say that you can't do that, right? Your job is to make the Torah relevant to the world, and use the best tools you have. And here we have a pretty clear set of values that we all are engaged in. So let's figure out whether it meets that or not. And we're all right, I think, that in a sense, in the same way I pointed out last week, that Rav Avadia had the luxury of not having to set standards, because the only question he was asked in terms of negotiation was, is it legitimate to have negotiations? Right, so you could just answer the question yes and not have to deal with the subsequent question, and what are your standards for negotiation? So Rav Henkin isn't being asked by the government to set his standards. So he can just say, look, I want you to be within the reasonable standards of governments. And if you came right and if you came down and you said, like, is this legitimate? He would say, look, is it a you can ask the question, is it a reasonable position that other governments might take? As long as within the range of the market, you're good enough. In the range of the market, there's always going to be a thing on the line, right? That's where you go back to Rabbi Yirmiya, right? Rabbi Yirmiya, who asked the question when the Gemara sets a standard for how far away fledglings have to be from the nest before you can keep them, as opposed to assuming they came from the closest nest. Mm-hmm. So the Gemara sets a standard, and Rabbi Yirmiya says, "What if it has 1 foot over the line and 1 foot and 1 foot not?" And they throw them out. you set a standard. There's always going to be a way to have 1 foot over the line, 1 foot not over the line, and right. That's just, that's not. Then you're just saying you can't make law. I think that's it. Okay. Right. So
market or no market.
Yeah.
It seems that based on the current demographics of the conflict, they will tend to go after Israelis more than anybody else. So there's that weighted thing there that may also impact.
Well, it's also the case now that that despite, I think, the rise of intersectionality in the political world, intersectionality in the terrorist world, I think, is no longer as prevalent. I guess it's unlikely that people, that the particular prisoners Israel is releasing would be, that there would be people capturing Italians in order to release those prisoners. Whereas it was, as we said, in the 70s, it was perfectly reasonable for terrorist groups to team up across, so that was a different kind of intersectionality.
I think that there are kidnappings of other groups by other terrorists. I mean, in Africa over the last bunch of years.
Right, but they're local. Yeah.
Right.
They're not, it's not like they're, okay, we can get more Nigerian prisoners released if we capture Israelis. I don't think it.
But I mean, if we're looking at the market, there are other places where kind of parallel types of events are happening between non-Jewish victims,
So I think the question is, as I'm fumbling, I guess, towards it, is that there are two issues, right? One is just thinking, are you overpaying for the market? And the second question is, the rationale to not allow you to overpay is the fear that people will capture Jews when they have a choice. So what happens if there is a market, but every market is exclusive? There's a market, but every market is exclusive. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that wasn't the case in the 70s, right? Let's say like Carlos the Jackal, right? Carlos the Jackal was an international terrorist. He could be hired by any group you want, and therefore any group that wanted Carlos, could capture, could figure out, are we better off, Are we better off capturing Argentinians, or are we better off capturing Israelis, Which way are we more likely to get Carlos released? And that's not the case anymore, which I think is probably a good thing. That we don't have that kind of international cooperation among terrorists. So you might argue that that even if the concept of market can still be established by figuring out what other governments will pay of their own prisoners, but actually Israel is negotiating against itself in all cases, and the whole framework doesn't apply at all in our reality, even though it would have, in Rafenka's reality. And so I can end it that way, saying I think that it's true, but it's perfectly fine for what it was, and has nothing to do with our situation because we're dealing with a totally different kind of market. There are all sorts of sports analogies, We could try and talk about, where you have people, players who negotiate within certain leagues, but nobody negotiates across leagues. I think that's a fairly reasonable way of framing it. I think that's personally what and I think we're probably right. I would probably say that it's probably true that that the technical claim of paying over the market should only exist in halakhically should probably exist in the context of the rationale. And if you can have a clear reason that the rationale is irrelevant, then you can probably claim the Gemara is irrelevant, even if you can establish a market. And that's probably what I would say. But you could also say, look, if we're being learned, we could say that's the machloket between the Maram Lublin and the Radbaz. Right? The Radbaz, who says the market is the hostage market, is dealing with the relative market. The Maram Lublin is dealing with something, is saying that you shouldn't overpay, and not because of the consequences, just he set it up. The way they framed the ruling was you shouldn't overpay. So we use the slave market, not the hostage market, because we don't want to overpay.
Is there anyone arguing today that Israel should not be negotiating.
Yeah.
With Hamas.
Yeah.
Rabbinical.
Yeah. Okay. Or, right, or as I say, one person saying yes, but only negotiate one for one.
Well, so specifically not negotiate at all.
Yeah, I think all you have to do is argue, I think all you have to do is argue that that release of any terrorist is overpaying. Mm-hmm. I think there are people who argue that, you know, that's a mistake. And as back then, Rav Henkin, you know, said that there, you know, that we don't like it when other governments, we just have to agree. And as soon as, and Rav Henkin would have right said, as soon as the other governments stop doing it, we should mm-hmm. stop as well. So if you think that we still live in a world in which, right, we don't release terrorists for hostages, maybe we do and maybe we don't. Mm-hmm. You know, in the U.S. case, it's been much more. The U.S. has not been releasing prisoners; it's been releasing money. So, if you think that releasing terrorists with blood on their hands is above the market for the world, so then sure, the U.S. should not.
Who did we just trade for that basketball player?
Ah, right, in Russia.
Yeah,
we should spies, but not murderers.
I thought it was an arms dealer, evil guy.
Arms dealer, evil guy. Yeah, but has he killed any Americans?
I didn't track.
Right, that's all right. The whole interesting question. Maybe you might argue, right? You could write a fascinating tshuva, you know, saying that the standard for Israel is Brittany Greer.
Uh-huh.
Right, and right, the U.S. sets the market, and whatever the U.S. was willing to release for Brittany Greer, you have to evaluate the Palestinian prisoners. As, right, Israel can't release more Palestinian prisoners. Or right, it has to have the prisoners have to be equal in value to the American, to the Russians that American traded for Brittany Greer, because that's the most recent precedent.
This gets back to, you know, interesting ways of how you measure markets. So like, who's the journalist from the Wall Street Journal still being held captive?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, he's still held captive, and I presume it's because the Russians want to keep him captive
because they haven't gotten an offer good enough yet.
But probably not because they haven't gotten an offer.
Right.
But that's also I don't know what that's also a government as opposed to, right, holding you captive. That raises the question. So what is Hamas? Right, you know, do we treat Hamas? Right, I think that probably the best argument against treating the contemporary situation as relevant is that at least at the outset, Hamas was not a band of pirates holding hostages. It's not just that the state that the state of Israel is a state, it's that Hamas was a quasi-state. And it might be that the reaction to, right, that we saw already in Amram Lublin, right? With Amram Lublin's whole issue was that there was a young man who was being held by the government,
mm-hmm.
and the risk was that if people paid to get this kid who was accused of, right, of sleeping with a Muslim woman, if we paid to get him off, the government could just trump up accusations against anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be that, you know, that the whole, you might argue that you never negotiate with governments.
But that was the government that held sway over that population.
That's right. So it's right.
This is a foreign government.
That's right. So it might be that all relations, right, that would be a Weiss type move, that nothing in the, even if you think that the halakhic precedents apply to situations where one party is a government, the situation where both parties are governments, that's a completely new universe. And then we can have interesting arguments about maybe once we destroy Hamas as a political entity, so we have reduced them to pirates. And so maybe we weren't allowed to negotiate at the outset, but having conducted a war of destruction, right, which reduces them, right? And maybe the issue whether you can enter negotiations depends on whether you think that the military goal of, right, of ending Hamas as a political force has been achieved or not. And those are all ways in which you can frame the discourse halakhically. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's not illegitimate for the political discourse among people who care about halakha to be framed halakhically, which is different than saying that the state is bound by halakha, but the citizens who are, right, who care about halakha within the state are entitled to make halakhic arguments about what the right policy should be. And then there are going to be intelligent ways to make them and dumb ways to make them. Right, I think that would be a.
Thank goodness we only follow the intelligent ones.
That would be. I think that's a contribution. But, you know, thank you, right, for coming out of this meeting. That, you know, that we can gradient the differences between the useful article, that gradient the ways in which you can the moves you have the number of ways removed from the Talmudic reality, the current reality is It's a different. Right? There's no slave market, right? We're not dealing with money. We're not dealing with money at all, right? If there's there is a market. There isn't a market. If there is a market, is the market international and competitive, or is the market just in negotiations in specific things? Does it? Well, one of the parties is a government. Both of the parties are governments. We can, you might say, like, one of the ways to solve the problem that Roy Weiss's approach raises is, you know what? If there are 4 degrees of separation from the Gemara, we're still willing to apply precedent. But when you get to 5 degrees of separation, at that point, you just throw up your hands and say, this is a totally new world. Mm-hmm. And we can't do that. And some people do it mechanically and say, like, 5 degrees of separation. And some people say, no, it depends on, on how, what angle the degree of separation is, right? How far it is, right? You can have all those debates. I think that's a very useful framing. And I think, a good thought experiment would be, like, to take the position that negotiations were illegitimate at the outset and became legitimate, and will become legitimate at the point at which Hamas is no longer a quasi-governmental body holding hostages, but just a group of criminals bargaining.
I wonder. Through all these discussions, I am continually surprised that there isn't established halacha on this. And that makes me wonder. I wonder how prevalent this has been over the centuries. Oh, so one thought is maybe it just hasn't happened that much. I mean, obviously it's happened, right? No.
But what has happened?
Hostage shaking from Jews. Does it?
In a position of power, you take hostages from those more powerful than you as a way to exercise power again, to rebalance the power.
There are lots of tribute about paying money, right? We saw that. There's a lot of tribute about paying money, Jews being held captive. And let's say, right, an interesting case that raised that I there is halakhic literature about, which I haven't assembled yet, where there was an Israeli, possibly businessman, who was kidnapped.
He's up in Lebanon.
What
the hell he was doing.
Right. And was there an obligation of Pidyon Shvuyim for the government? Well, that could just be money. And maybe, right? So maybe, so we could frame it. I think that, Arnaud is entirely right that, that we don't have.
He was released. There was some.
And the whole question was he really, what was he really? Right? All those sorts of questions. I think, what if we had a Brittany Greer situation? Right, where it's just another government, holding it just to squeeze Israel, but some other policy thing, right? Because they want cheaper solar panels. I think what I say is that it's rare that all the interesting halakhic questions are because the reality is different, and there are lots of ways which reality has shifted dramatically. We live in a world of more radical social and technological change any time in the past. So you can say there's no halakha of any. Obviously, there are no real halakhic press. So I'll go back to that case of Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Bick. Right, so what do we do with that case? So there is a medrash Rabbi Bleich found. Right, the medrash says that that Yosef was originally in Yosef Binyamin. Binyamin is right. Binyamin is originally in Leah's womb, but she realizes that Rachel will have fewer children than Bilhah and Zilpah, and that will diminish her stature among the foremothers of Israel. And so she prays, and so Dinah and Binyamin are switched. Now, Dinah is considered the daughter of Leah, and Binyamin is considered the son of Rachel. So that proves to you that it's the mother who you give birth to, not the egg mother. Right. So the question is, like, is that a good way to make halakha? Because you have a story in the past which appears to address this question. Mm-hmm. Right. The question about how you deal with artificial insemination. Right. So there's a medrash in which, about the birth of Ben Sira, which makes it into rabbinic literature, in which the prophet Jeremiah is forced to ejaculate in a public bath. And the semen travels downstream, and impregnates Ben-Sira's mother, and that's how Ben-Sira, right? So that tells you that Ben-Sira is still considered the son of Jeremiah. Right? Do you want to use that as precedent, or do you say, like, no, actually, right, you know, speculations, fantastical speculations, right, in a world where this could not be done deliberately, mm-hmm. right, should not, set public policy, right, for an era when it can be done deliberately, mm-hmm. with entirely different consequences. So the answer is, you can see the argument both ways. You can say, look, they thought about the moral question. And they addressed the moral question, right? Who cares whether they were dealing with a reality that, with a technical reality, right? They thought about the question, and it was obvious to them that this is the mother, and this is the father, and who, right? And now we have something presenting the precedent. Now you have the argument, oh yeah, but it's not halacha; it's like, okay, right? And that's a totally technical argument. You can say, no, this is crazy. Obviously, a situation where we could ensure, if we wished, as a state decree, that all children had different egg mothers than birth mothers by requiring everyone, right? We could have a, or we could live in a brave new world where all children are test tube babies, right? So if brave new world were halachic, right? Were in rabbinic literature, would that decide our position about artificial insemination? Because they thought about it in great depth and not just in one story, but somebody had written a whole novel about the implications, right? So I think that issue comes up everywhere. All interesting halakhic questions involve radical gaps from the past, and the whole context is always so different that I'm always influenced by. I know this argument from Bertrand Russell, though I think probably didn't originate it. The question that you can't really ever talk about causality as a logical matter, because you never know for sure that what actually caused the thing previously was the whole condition of the world. Right, because there are chaotic systems, and maybe the only reason that A leads to B is because there's a butterfly flapping its wings in the appropriate place. And so now we know certain systems are highly sensitive to initial conditions, but maybe we just don't know the initial conditions. Everything else is sensitive too, and therefore causality is impossible, because you can never repeat the entire condition of the world, previously. So it could be that the halacha is a chaotic system, and any shift in the world, it really should ramify throughout all of halacha. And
it's like a predictability versus a causality.
Yeah, right. So, but it could be, right? It could be that all of halacha is irrelevant in a world where it's unenforceable. That's a radical shift, right? The Enlightenment comes along, and there's no longer a community capable of enforcing halacha on its members. Everything's voluntaristic, so. All decisions have been made differently, right? Because previously you had to make decisions on the assumption that you can enforce your decisions, and now you can't. Maybe you can enforce some of them. There's so many, right? The whole relationship to authority is different. So maybe the whole concept of halakha has to change.
You've talked about this before, at least I've heard you talk about it before. It seems there are lots of communities where effectively you can't, right? There is no jail. That is true. But effectively, in lots of communities.
Okay, so maybe I overstated the facts, right? Right. Those are all the things. But I think
hard is in a community that straddles both worlds.
Yeah, I gave a share this past week, right, which I started by talking about the areas of sex and gender. There are nine things that were previously thought to be causally intrinsically connected, mm-hmm. that now we see as accidental. Like most simply that we assumed it was obvious that an element of sex was the risk of procreation, and that procreation required sex. Right, those were things that we thought, like, those were intrinsic qualities of sex and procreation. They're not true anymore. You have effective birth control, and you have IVF. So maybe everything is different. Maybe everything is different. Right, let's say people argue reasonably, right? So therefore, the notion that we should oppose, unions that can't biologically lead to procreation is silly now, because procreation and sex are totally unlinked. Or no, that's false, right? They're still, right? The fact that we can make efforts to unlink them doesn't mean that intrinsically they aren't linked. And, maybe our theology is built on the intrinsic link, even though we have now found technological ways to break them apart. Maybe we should celebrate that we have technological ways. Maybe we should mourn. And all right. So every area is going to have claims that reality has shifted in dramatic. Obviously, at least we talk about in SBM, right? Tum Shabbos. All right, so Tum Shabbat, right? How can that not be affected by the speed at which we can now travel? And how can that, in a sense, not be affected by Einstein? But now that we realize that distance and time are really the same, right? Distance and time are really the same thing. So we should reconsider that whole area of Hilchot Shabbat, because or similarly, right? I think that was the big error I made for the students. But right, whatever, you have a population density at such a point that it's possible that the whole world is in a single Tum Shabbat. and I constructed arguments, right? There is a particular occupation under which you can get the entire populated world into a single Tum Shabbat. So is that wrong? Because obviously there's supposed to be some kind of boundary, and the fact that, right, so the position, even though it might have been a perfectly reasonable position 100 years ago, it didn't have the consequence, but now it has the consequence of eliminating Tum Shabbat. Right, what about the alternative position, right, which argues that the only place left in the world where there isn't Tum, where you cannot walk as far as you want, is Manhattan. Because the requirement of Tum Shabbat is you have to have contiguous houses that have open space around them. So maybe, right, open garden space. Maybe Manhattan is the only place which is not a single city for the purpose, right, for the purpose of halakha. And Manhattanites can just stay within, right, or have to stay within, X distance of their lobbies. Whereas, people living in upstate New York, right, we have found ways to connect, right? So I think that's an impossible position. Right, but it's interesting, Jose raises the question, right? Maybe when we construct cities, can we construct them vertically? Right, we have our standard, right, three domiciles each holding, right? The Chazon says, no, obviously the Gemara is dealing with horizontal things, not vertical things, and we can even test cases where the Gemara doesn't care about verticality, only cares about it. But does that work for the, right, for Trump Tower? All these people are living, right? So every area of halakha is right, can be right, can be subject to that, or you can say no, it's the job of the community to keep halakha alive.
So there's I think there's another way to possibly look at it, which is to say, with the example of Tum Shabbat, if you take the idea that halakha is part of this chain, it originates in Sinai. It's possible that the halakha as received at Sinai was meant to eventually encompass the world. That, like, if the entire world is a Tum Shabbat and the whole idea of Tum Shabbat becomes irrelevant, that might have been part of the original plan.
Sure.
And so we're just discovering more and more about what that
could be. It could be this is a symbolic of the Messianic era.
Right.
Right. We are now all one. We used to have to engage with these artificial things, sharing food and kitchens and things like that to try and create community. But now halakha, right, everyone realizes that we live in a single interconnected community, and the way we make, right, and halakha is very powerful about that because it tells you, look, a few years ago it would have been forbidden for you to walk to your friend's house, and
with having lights on Shabbat, having electric lights that'll stay on. You can turn the light on before Shabbat starts and it just stays on. And you can have your Shabbat dinner and sing Zmirot until 2 in the morning. And, for thousands of years, that was impossible. And yet, there's something that feels so, like, that's Shabbat. There's something so special about it. It feels like somehow it was built into the original plan. And they just didn't know it for, a couple thousand years until light bulbs were invented.
Right. The question is, so that's easy for us. 7 years on and the era of circumstances. but they couldn't have known that when the question first came up. They didn't have the experience,
right?
And so they might reasonably have said, "No, you're not allowed." Right? All electric lights have to go off at the point at which a wood fire would burn out in the same. Right? We could have constructed a universe about that, because this way people stay up all night, and everybody misses shul the next morning. Right? Also, the way they could have constructed that. So I think that's right. Life will say. That's the job of poskim,
right?
And then over time, right, poskim make different decisions, and the community has experience. Over time, some of those decisions survive, And some of those decisions people look at and say, no. You know, like, what will we think about the tissue buff comes in, right? It's time same as it's an example of the way in which the world has changed is that, right? We, you know, is that now large sections of the Orthodox community sing on tissue buff and get together to sing on tissue buff. That's crazy. Right? That's great. And, you know, it's all very well and good to say you get together and sing sad songs, but the experience of singing sad songs collectively, right, you know, is not the same as the experience of our experience of mourning together. And we're not singing dirges. We're singing songs with sad lyrics, maybe, and which are intermixed with songs of, now that was always true about the liturgy, but it's not liturgical anymore, right? It's obvious that people are getting together separately because singing is cathartic, right? And that's not clear that Tisha was intended cathartically. And for myself, it's years ago, I lost a friend for a good period of time because I talked to the friend after Yom Kippur, and I was in a black mood after Yom Kippur. I called the friend and I said, so how was your Yom Kippur? And their response was, it was great. The singing was wonderful. And I, being a young and pleasant person, they said, yes, but how was your Yom Kippur? And the singing was good. Like, what on earth does that have to do with, you know, that would work just as well for Sukkot. You know, that was the that's the whole, you know, because the experience of singing is to some extent the same experience, whether or not you you do that. So I think that's I think that those are all great questions. All right. They once again succeeded in preventing the serious mending. So we'll come back next week, I guess. Hopefully we'll be here.
Oh my goodness. Thank you.
And we'll talk about Rebecca's other things that we'll try once again. we can finish this series. Although now maybe I have to go look for all the literature about that I missed about the intermediate case. Probably not. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.